Celebrating neurodivergent writing, books and creativity. Welcome to the NeuroLit podcast with your host, Morwenna Stewart.
Hi, I'm Morwenna Stewart. I'm awesomely autistic and ADHD. I'm also founder and coach at yourwritingpartner.co.uk. Follow us for writing tips on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, TikTok, YouTube, pretty much all over the place. You're listening to the podcast NeuroLit, where we celebrate neurodivergent writers, artists and creatives. Today we are talking with the very lovely Rosemary Richings. Rosemary is a writer, editor and public speaker specialising in disability and neurodiversity related subject matter. She's the author of Stumbling Through Space and Time, Living Life with Dyspraxia. Rosemary's writing has been featured in Travel and Leisure, Broken Pencil magazine, Happy Fall magazine, and a long list of many other websites and all sorts of exciting things. So great to have you here with us, Rosemary. Great.
Yay! Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Really cool to have you here. And it's a Friday, so we're both beaming from ear to ear, which is really nice.
Yeah, always good vibes on
always good vibes. Always good vibes on a Friday. And I can see us both if you're watching, because we're recording for sound and for video as well. So we've both got our lippy on and we're looking at our most glamorous, I think, I have to say. So Rosemary, what brought you to write? Because it's quite an unusual, even within the neurodiversity world, dyspraxia is kind of one of the Cinderella syndrome type things, isn't it? Cinderella diagnoses. What brought you to write that?
Very much so. I mean, I always refer to it with people as like kind of the awkward sibling of the rest of that whole umbrella. And yeah. I mean, that's part of it, though. I mean, I grew up in Canada. And I didn't really know anyone else who had that diagnosis back when I got it. And I wrote it because I was writing from the perspective of something I really, really wished I had back then. I really, really wished I could give my family back then. And I thought about it for a while. I just wasn't quite sure how to angle it for the longest time. And then I think it was 2019, as far as I recall, I started to sort of start playing with a chapter per week and starting to try and write down some of my experiences. I went to writing groups. I went to Shut Up and Write groups and I got some mentorship eventually. And so it was written because I wanted to just make it all make sense in a way that I didn't think was actually available.
That's brilliant. Thank you for sharing that. And I was looking online and doing my research and I couldn't find very many books out there. I mean, there's a couple of organizations, but there's not a huge literature out there. So was that partly what motivated you to write it?
Yeah. I mean, there was very few books, yeah, for sure. But like the majority were parents and practitioners and things like that. And before I wrote this book, I could only really name one like patient perspective. So like someone who's dyspraxic themselves. And that was basically it. I couldn't find any others. And I wanted to change that.
Fantastic. There's a big gap and it seems like there's a market for more actually when I was looking out there, so maybe there's more books in you and a future in that, so that's really interesting.
I mean, I'm playing around with some future ideas, but they're so not final at this point that I don't want to like formally announce anything on the podcast at this point.
No, that's absolutely fine. So what was it like? I mean, growing up, and you said, you didn't have a diagnosis young, did you? Is that right?
Yeah, I was really young. That was part of a lot of the journey was about that. I was only 4, so there was a lot about myself I didn't really know yet. And I had to rely on a lot of family support to figure out accommodations at school and outside of that and such. And it was a big shocker as I got older to have to suddenly like do it all myself and fill out all this paperwork and everything like that.
So did you have quite a bit of support when you were kind of growing up that helped?
Yeah. My family was great. My parents were really trying to learn more, even though they had so little to work off of. And I had a few good teachers when I was young, and some great people who were part of the diagnosis process and everything like that, and some of the initial OT. And I did therapeutic horseback riding at one point. And that came from a recommendation. And little things like that made a really big difference.
Fantastic. So there were definite kind of physical therapies that were helpful that you wrote about.
And I had someone who was part of getting me the early diagnosis recommendation stuff that was really the early school of thought on neurodiversity and recognizing some value in that. So,
And how did those kinds of things help you? Because, I mean, I have a very basic understanding of dyspraxia. I know much more about autism, ADHD, and a bit of dyslexia. But, you know, what was it that you were struggling with, and how did those kinds of therapies help, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, a lot of it was environmental adjustments. Yeah. Early on, it was about being able to process information. There's a current school of thought, and I think it's very accurate, about dyspraxia being under the window of sensory conditions. And I think that's very accurate. So you need a very specific environment to process information and not be overwhelmed. And that very much carried over into my later years as well.
Okay. Like, so it sounds like it's quite an environmental sensory thing. That's what I'm hearing. Crossover.
Yeah. Because essentially the key word is coordination. So a lot of it's about your relationship with your environment and how you react to your environment, and a delay in processing where you should go, what someone means when they say, like, hey, turn right, turn left. Even figuring out the limitations, figuring out a crowd, figuring out how you get on a bus and get from point A to B, all that is part of the bigger picture.
So kind of navigating a way around places and things like that.
Yeah.
Gotcha. And am I right in saying that it's kind of the sort of micro and the macro? It's the small motor movements and the larger motor movements as well. Is that right?
Yeah, both the bigger and the smaller. Yeah, it's that big keyword of coordination and understanding what other people are saying in terms of their instructions as well, their movement-based instructions.
Okay, that's really interesting. Thank you for clarifying that. So it's also processing auditory information about movement.
Yeah, that's a big part of things. And that is really the most underrated sort of combination. I remember going on some more corporate audience stuff, and I made a big point of that being the first thing I mentioned, because so many of my friends in the community, part of where they struggle in conventional workplaces is they'll be left out and forgotten about because people will give them instructions in a verbal context that are quite complex, and what the movements are quite complex, and the you do this, then you do that, then you do that. And they're giving them too much to do at once, and it needs to be written down, or it needs to be put in an alternate format, or not trying to overload them with information.
Gotcha. There's definite crossover with autism by the sounds of it, because, I mean, a lot of that is about sequencing of information and being overloaded with information. So it sounds like there's a bit of a Venn diagram there of some of those traits and characteristics.
Oh, yeah, that's where both often overlap, and it's very common for someone to have both.
Yeah. That's definitely what I've been reading these days. I mean, if you're one, you're more likely to be two or three or four. You know, there's a kind of... Some people are talking about the neurodivergent mind, and actually there are just traits of all these different things, and there's not kind of distinct boundaries.
Yeah, and a lot of the diagnosis stuff hasn't really caught up to that yet. Like, people are often really just looking for one of the tick boxes, not more than that.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'd agree with that, with what you're saying. So you wrote the book, and I've been I'm a real skim reader, so I read some bits from it, and I don't tend to read the whole thing, but there's some brilliant bits in it about, well, very moving bits about bullying and that, you know, the impact that had on you. You'll be able to kind of talk a little bit about that and what that was
like?
Yeah,
I mean, that's a common thing for sure. And I faced that because a lot of it was about misunderstanding. And I'm a very public objector of the term special education, because even though that's very much embedded in the best intentions and the traditions, it very much puts a target on your back of like, hey, bully me.
Yeah.
sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. It absolutely can do, can't it? And I agree with you. And I think the term itself, it sort of singles people out. Why are their needs particularly special? They're just human needs rather than special needs. So I have a problem with that. So you felt singled out?
Yeah, I very much felt singled out for sure. And whenever, I mean, it was hard to speak up. So it was always about either being singled out or people just like not quite understanding what's up.
Mm. And was there any kind of attempt when you were in school education to kind of educate people, other people?
Not really. I mean, people really didn't have any understanding yet about dyspraxia. I mean, they kind of understood ADHD and autism a little bit, but not that much at that point. So it was a little harder of a conversation to have because there was less tools around.
Yeah, I can imagine. And as I said, even me in the neurodiversity world, it's something I just don't know very much about. I think dyspraxia and dyscalculia, you know, they're less well known for sure. So I love some things you were talking about. It's just kind of going back about thinking about the writing itself. And you mentioned some really interesting structure there. What was it that kind of helped you to get the right structure for you? What worked for you?
I started off quite loosely with returning to my tradition of fiction writing, my old ancient history of that, and being what's called, I don't know if all listeners would know this term, but a pantser. I started off in my first chapter being a bit of a pantser. Someone introduced this to me in a writing group I was part of. You're either a planner or you're a pantser.
Oh, the planner. What's that? Yeah.
So the planner means that you have detailed outlines. You're the kind of person that would put a bunch of sticky notes on the wall to figure out all your different steps. But the pantser is the opposite. You're basically flying by the seat of your pants.
That's what I thought it might be. That makes sense. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, but then I lost track of my thoughts a little bit, and I started to feel like I needed to have a more detailed outline, and that was very much when I started to have an actual mentor and coach involved, and I started to get more detailed resources involved. I started to talk to people in my community, and I was like, this can't just be my story. If I'm going to make this anything, it needs to be so much more. So it went from that initial sort of going from the, I will record whatever I record, to just having a very detailed, I want to cover these subjects because I know they're important.
Yeah. So it sounds like starting off from a first person perspective and then going out to a sort of more universal perspective for other people. Yeah. Nice. And so you've got a mentor and your coach and some writing groups, and that was really interesting to hear, because I know everybody works in their own way, and you're either a planner or a pantser. And what kind of things happened in the groups that you found helpful?
Well, the fact that they weren't disabled and they weren't neurodivergent in any ways, it was very insightful because I could just read something and have an outside perspective of, is this immediately helpful and interesting and things like that. And I think early on in the groups that helped. The Shut Up and Write group one was more so just about like not having the distraction of social media, though not having the distraction of social media or any other responsibilities. They've been quite successful. I've seen them in a lot of different cities all over, and I think that's really a concept that resonates with a lot of people.
Oh, brilliant. Okay. So there was two things you got from it. I was hearing one was the Shut Up and Write groups, where you've got the kind of focus and they're in different places. And the other one was the perspective of a group that wouldn't know the subject matter, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then later on, I started to get more involved in the dyspraxia community, it was useful just to listen to what other people were saying and learn from that. And I found that my later drafts were informed by that and just hearing what other people were concerned about.
Where do you think you got your best feedback? Was it from non-experts or experts? Or a bit of both?
Bit of both, because I was very aware that, like, I wasn't just going to get the patients. It was also going to be the parents. It was also going to be someone's educator or someone's employer or something like that. So I really, really needed a bit of both so that it wasn't just me drifting in my own world and my own narrative.
Yeah, great. That's a really interesting idea, isn't it? That we need different readers, you know, different editors and readers to kind of give us that different perspective. Did you talk to family and friends as well? Was that something you did?
Yeah, in the later stages, I was worried that their interference would interfere too much with my own process. So later on, as they started to also find my old documents, my old medical documents, my old report cards, things like that, a lot just organically started to come up of things that my family members remembered that stuck out to them. And I, of course, said, well, this is going in the book. This could be public as long as you're fine with this.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course. Yeah. I mean, that's a line that we all have to tread, I guess, when we're writing, you know, autobiographical type things of that kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. I had to be careful more so with the patients I found, because I found that, like, people are very sort of vulnerable in the advocacy sort of support context. Mm-hmm. So whenever I brought up something that was quite difficult, I had to really, like, have no sort of way of showing, like, where they're from, how old they are, things like that.
Yeah, yeah. And obviously there's kind of issues of confidentiality and all of those kinds of things, which makes writing, you know, that bit more complicated, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting. So what did you kind of, it sounds like you spoke to different people and you had different people acting as your readers and getting feedback from them. But did you have a specific reader or set of readers in mind who you were writing for?
Really, it was just a past version of my parents, my family, myself. And I knew there was a lot of those kinds of people out there. And that was really the bottom line throughout. And that helped me whenever I found myself getting a bit sidetracked and going on about something that really wouldn't be that exciting to anyone else.
Ah, gotcha. So it was almost like writing for your former self and for your family. Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha. And what have you know, what's the feedback been like from people who have read the book? I've seen some 5-star reviews on Amazon and things. What have you heard?
Yeah, I've got some DMs and things like that, some feedback on social media, and it's mostly been from parents and people who were diagnosed in their adulthood. And they've found it really helpful just to have the sense of reaffirming this.
And kids themselves read it, or is it mostly parent groups and things?
Yeah, mostly parent groups, and a lot of the people who were dyspraxic themselves were, like, much older. I would say youngest of who actually talked to me would be roughly 20s.
Okay. Fantastic. So for helpful for families and and the kids and kind of coming through. Yeah. Great. Fantastic. What was I going to ask? So that was your one big book, and you're also working on something else. Is that something you want to talk about today, or is that not where you want to go?
Yeah, I mean, it's all such early phases that I don't know. It could change. It's so early step.
Yeah, bit early to talk about. Yeah. I know what that's like. You don't want to sort of talk too much about it, perhaps. I was curious. I mean, I quite often ask people this, you know, if you could kind of have your time again, is there anything you would do differently about writing the book?
I would be much, much more structured, much quicker, and add more practical exercises, ways to be more introspective, if that's something someone's considering, things like that.
So more structure for you in the actual writing process?
Yeah, in the writing process, yeah.
What kind of structure do you think kind of works for you now, knowing what you know as a writer?
I mean, it's interesting because what I didn't plan for is that in my freelance writing, it helped me much more than I anticipated to approach it the same, of having detailed outlines and a lot of like electronic records of this bit of research or this interview I did with this person, things like that, just to have things in one place and just have a very cohesive layout of how I'm approaching things and what people are looking for and that.
So having quite a structured way of working
was
a useful way for you. Gotcha. Yeah. And it sounds like, as you said, the kind of writing groups and working with lots of different people and getting lots of different input. Do you think it's possible? Do you think some people do okay just writing on their own and not getting any input from other people?
Depends. I mean, it's very hard with things like this where you're going into the personal and it's a disability thing and you have the potential of like someone seeing it as a universal perspective, which was very much my biggest anxiety early on. I think you have to be careful with things where you're representing a whole community. But like if it's something like fiction, if it's separate from reality, then you can somewhat get away with just going with the flow of your own kind of story and what feels natural.
That's an interesting perspective. So with the sort of more factual stuff, perhaps, or the sort of disability stuff, you maybe want to get people's perspectives to see if you're kind of capturing more universal points. But fiction is different. Yeah, that's an interesting point.
Yeah, unless you have like a disabled character or like you have a gay character and you're straight or whatever, like that's when you really need outside input.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, fantastic. So what's kind of coming into the future for you? You don't really want to talk too much about the book, but you're blogging and other bits and pieces.
Oh, what else is exciting? Well, I'm really leaning much more into the lived experience angle in my work and the writing I do and the editing I do for people. And I'm doing much more public speaking. Like I've really enjoyed getting into that area much more so. And yeah, it's been great to get into that a little bit more. And the doors this book has opened to that a little bit more. And that's very much what I've been reaching out to and going for.
So it's kind of broadened out the opportunities for you into other areas.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. What kind of who do you talk to? To talk to kind of employers, work groups at work? Oops. Who do you talk to?
So it's been much more corporate audiences for the speaking engagements, and for the writing it's been kind of a mix of corporate and various publications and such.
Fantastic. And talking about dyspraxia, and do you find that people know much about it, or is it just like a blank slate when you go and talk to people?
It varies. I mean, more often than not, they don't know much about it. But I find that it's easier to approach it from a broader angle of neurodiversity and then bringing my own perspective into it. And also talking to people in my own community. I mean, I think being this plugged into the advocacy side of things has been amazing because I have all these great people. I can always get a second opinion on things and help them with their projects and have that inform things and sort of tap into that deep anxiety I'm always trying to like address, which is that I'm one person, I'm one perspective. And I want to also be engaging with other perspectives too.
Absolutely. So it sounds like you do quite a bit of advocacy type things. Is that with kind of charities or kind of
I'm on the board of trustees of Dyspraxic Me currently. Excellent. And they work with dyspraxic young adults on peer support initiatives. And I'm with some more independent advocacy groups. I know someone called Crystal Shaw, who she has the Dyspraxia magazine. And from time to time, I've helped her with events and with the magazine and stuff like that. And Dyspraxic Alliance, which is just a collaboration between a few independent advocates.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Well, that's going to get you the really good experience and very practical sort of support and things, isn't it?
I think that continues to inform my work. And I always make that clear to people that that's part of everything I'm working on too.
Yeah. Yeah. Really important. Fantastic. Wonderful. It's been really interesting hearing about your process of writing. Do you think there's anything specific about being a dyspraxic writer in terms of what you maybe do differently to other people?
Well, I more so have to accept that I have a different way of looking at spatial concepts. So I always have to be very aware of that in how I perceive my ideas and my structure of an article or how I might go from one point to the other. And I think that's both a good and a bad thing. Like, I think it makes more people feel like there's more perspectives that can be valid. And that's cool.
That is very cool. It's very cool. I mean, that's what neurodiversity is all about, really, isn't it? It's getting people to understand that we all think differently. And that's a great, great thing. And world's great tapestry kind of thing, isn't it? So that we bring a lot to the world, which is what we're about as well. Yeah. Fantastic. What would you like to sort of see change in the world of dyspraxia? How would you like people to kind of understand or support people better?
I mean, it's a lot of what I have to say about disability more broadly speaking. I know this from, my introduction to before I leaned into my own lived experience advocacy stuff was through being part of the Insulin for All movement. My husband was on the charity of that, board of that for a while, and I did some volunteering with them. And really that allowed me to tap into a much broader set of issues around that are quite life and death. And I think that many of these things really do speak to the broader disability community and really just to stop the sort of stereotyping and to lean more into paying disabled people fairly and being respectful. I mean, there's such negativity that gets in the media and popular culture around that. And we've got a long way to go.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, it's very much the case in the UK and all around the world. We're all at different points in that journey. But great. Absolutely agree with that. Anything else you want to kind of cover? Anything else you want to share with us that we haven't already kind of dug into today?
No, I think that's good.
Excellent. Well, I'm really pleased to be reading the book and finding out more about an area that I didn't really know very much about. So thank you very much for the book. And I would encourage people to read it because it is a less well-known area of diversity, of neurodiversity. So I've learned a lot from it. Thank you. Thank you, Rosemary. Yeah. And we look forward to next projects. And if you want to come back and talk to us, again, we'd love to have you on, talk more about whatever projects are coming up for you. So that would be really great. Thank you. Fantastic. So thank you so much, Rosemary, for joining us today. And to everybody who's listening, thanks for listening to the podcast. We'll share the info that Rosemary has mentioned on our podcast platforms. Do share our podcasts with your family, friends, colleagues, and check out my book on Amazon as well, which is 5 Steps to Publish, a very short, snappy book about some simple steps to take. Until next time, thank you so much for listening.